Our speaker this evening is Tom Jordan, and Tom is a senior scientist here at CERC. He received his BS in biology from Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, a PhD in biology from Boston University, that would be in Massachusetts. His research is on the transport and transformation of nitrogen and phosphorus in the ecosystems. Since starting at CERC in 1980, he studied the sources of nutrient releases from watersheds, the uptake of nutrients by wetlands, riparian forests and trees, and the fates and effects of nutrients in estuaries, especially in the Chesapeake Bay and its watershed. So, without any further ado, I give you Tom.
Thank you, Bruce. It's great to see so many people and so many friends out there in the audience, and I'm pleased to tell you about some of the things I'm working on that continue my interest in what happens to nitrogen and phosphorus, where they come from, and how do we slow them down from getting into Chesapeake Bay. So, Kristen came up with this wonderful title for my talk. I hope that I can live up to actually giving you a clearer picture of stream restoration. So I'm going to be comparing stream restorations in two very different watersheds. One of which is dear to us here at CERC, and that's the CERC watershed, where we have many long-term study sites. And of course, it's not a city. It's a sort of a country place with fields and forests.
I'm trying to figure out the ideal lighting situation. Sorry, Tom.
It's fine. I've got dimmers over here.
Oh.
Yeah. So what do you want to do? Light the part of the back? Turn on the, what lights you want to light. Okay.
Is this a good
setting
for
everyone?
There you go.
Yeah. There you go. Perfect. It takes a scientist.
Right. Well, I'm glad I could invite you, but not too much. And then, of course, we're going to be talking about a city stream. Boy, you were right about that, how when you turn your head, it changes the loudness. But I'll just get on with it then. So this stream has urban stream syndrome. You may have seen this if you go to a city park somewhere where there's a stream in some woods. A lot of times you see.
You're good.
Yeah.
She's taking care of it.
All right. Okay, my intern here was, before we restored the stream, she's standing in the bottom of Bunny Creek. And you can see that it's a deeply eroded stream.
Where?
It's right near CERC, actually.
Muddy Creek. Mm-hmm. You said, I wasn't if it was a Muddy Creek or it's Muddy Creek.
It's called Muddy Creek, and okay. It's called that for a reason. Yes, good question, actually. And you can see by these dangling roots on the stream bank how much erosion is taking place, and bank erosion in particular. And what's happening now is, or the way the stream is in this picture, it's been decoupled from its floodplain. In other words, even during high flow, the water in the stream does not rise high enough to go out over the floodplain as it would normally do. So the water is confined to this narrow, deeply incised sort of ditch in a way, in a sense. And that means that when the water flows, it flows really fast. And that makes it not a great habitat for the stream organisms that have to hang on to the bottom. So a lot of people would like to restore streams like that. But what do we mean by restoring, or what do we mean by restoration? We're not really trying to make the stream be the way it was before humans got here, but rather to restore some functionality of the stream, things that we care about. And here's some of the reasons. We want to stop the erosion caused by urban runoff, reconnect the stream with its floodplain, and control flooding downstream, improve stream habitats, and The main motivation for funding these things, really, is to reduce discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, and suspended solids into Chesapeake Bay. So nitrogen and phosphorus are essential elements for all living things, and they often limit the growth of plants and algae. The cycles of nitrogen and phosphorus have been really severely altered by human activities. And overloading of coastal waters has been the result. So not just Chesapeake Bay, but coastal waters around the world are getting too much nitrogen and phosphorus, which causes some problems. And for example, in Chesapeake Bay, the excess nutrients and sediments have caused algal blooms, low dissolved oxygen, loss of submerged aquatic vegetation, food web disruption, and reductions in nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment loads to the Chesapeake Bay are now mandated by the EPA to get the loads down below the total daily, the total maximum daily load. So Chesapeake Bay is on a pollution diet. So the question is, can stream restorations help? Studies show variable but potentially significant improvements in nutrient reduction with stream restoration. But different restoration approaches differ, and streams differ, and the long-term effectiveness of restorations is not known. So we did this restoration in Muddy Creek, which is a stream that we've been studying since the mid-1970s. And this, again, is how it looked before the restoration. Where I'm standing there, it's 10 feet from the stream bed to the floodplain. And yet, despite this erosion that looks like urban stream syndrome, the watershed is about half forested. It's got some pasture and hay fields and some fallow fields. And it's only about 14% residential land and 2% row crops. But this is the reason why there's a big problem, and that's the culvert that was put in when the road was built across the floodplain of the stream. A single culvert was put in the road to carry the stream under the road. Before that, the stream could form braided channels that would cross the floodplain and spread the flow out. And so it didn't dig down so deeply. But once it was focused, funneled through that one culvert, it started to dig a deep ditch, essentially. So the first step in restoring the stream was to put a perforated pipe in the ditch to carry some of the stream flow, the base flow, during the restoration process. And then there was a lot of dump trucks involved in carrying fill, because the plan was to raise the stream up till it's close to the level of the floodplain. And they put in layers of gravel on the bottom, and on top of that, sand mixed with wood chips. And the name for this kind of restoration is a regenerative stormwater conveyance, or an RSC for short. When they got to the bottom, they kept putting, you know, sand and wood chips and so forth. They could drive their vehicles over that. And when they got to the bottom, they installed a V-notch weir. And this is what we use to help us measure the flow of the water leaving the stream, because the depth of the flow is related, the depth of the water is related to the flow by the V-notch weir. So this is the as-built diagram for after the restoration was done. I want to point out some features. So the original stream channel was just following along here. In a pretty simple straight line, and it was really deeply incised. It looked kind of like a drainage ditch, and it acted like a drainage ditch. So the restoration involved first filling the stream, and then once they did that, they started to build these berms across to go from one side of the valley to the other. And that's to stop the stream from cutting a new channel after the restoration, because it might cut a new channel, and that channel could dig down, and you'd have to be back where you started from. The other thing is, these berms could be used to deflect the stream flow over this very wide and low part of the floodplain. And in addition to that, they installed rock weirs at intervals. And I'll show you a picture of a rock weir. And those things help prevent further erosion. Now, since they deflected all this flow here, they created a bunch of wetlands here. And also, you know, the stream is reconnected to its floodplain. So now the water can spread out over the floodplain, and suspended sediments in the water can settle out in the floodplain. The plants and microorganisms in the soil can get at the nutrients and take some of the nutrients up. And by spreading out, the water slows down, so it's less erosive. Here's the end of the stream after restoration. You can see the V-notch weir, and that's an automated sampling system. We put one at each end of the stream. And we put them in place before the restoration, 1 year before, so we could get information on what was going into the stream and going out of the stream before the restoration and then after the restoration, and see what change we can relate to the restoration. And so by putting in these rock weirs and berms, they created pools at intervals along the stream. And here's a riffle going over a rock weir. And so there's now that the stream has riffles and pools, like a lot of streams do. This generates habitat diversity, as well as preventing the erosion from cutting the stream back down to where it was before. So, as I mentioned, we put in automated samplers at the upstream end and the downstream end. It's about 450 meters of reach, stream reach, to get from one end to the other. We also put in transects of groundwater sampling wells and piezometers that cross the stream and go into the floodplain on either side. So I want to say something about the automated samplers, because that's an important feature. Those samples take samples in proportion to the flow. And the way that works is there's big jugs for the sample to accumulate in over a week period. And there's a pump in the system that will pump water at intervals depending on how much flow has occurred. So here's an example. This shows the flow rate discharge in cubic meters per second plotted against time for just an example flow event. So this would have been a rainstorm or something that made the flow increase. And these red dots here show when the pump would be triggered. And you can see that when the flow is high, the pump is triggered a lot. So the composite sample at the end that has accumulated over a week, it has more water in it that was occurring during periods of high flow. And so that means that the concentrations of substances that we measure in that water are, they reflect the average concentration in the water, in all the water that flowed past the station during the week. And that's really important because a lot of times there are flow events like this will carry a lot of suspended sediments, and you can get transport of a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus happening in just a few hours. So if you just go out and sample your stream every week or something, you're likely to miss the big flow events. That's why we have the automated samplers. Okay, and I think I covered all that. So
this shows
the watershed where the RSC, the restored reach, is located. And these yellow lines show the watershed boundary of the watershed. And these red dots
are locations where CERC has automated samplers that we've been running since the mid-1970s.
And so we've got a good handle on what's coming out of these different watersheds. And we use this watershed that has the restoration as a sort of a treatment watershed compared to this control watershed
right next to it with very similar land use.
So we can see if there's a difference
before and after
the restoration was put in. And of course, we're measuring what goes into the restored region, what comes out of the bottom. And then we can compare what flows past this sampling station and that one to see what's happening at a larger scale. So to calculate how much flow occurs, flow of nutrients, I mean, you just multiply the concentration of the nutrient by the water flow, and that gives you what they call the load, how much flow passed the station. And by just taking the load that left and subtracting it from the load that came in, you can calculate how much was removed. And the percent removed, we calculate based on how much came in. So we can calculate the percentage of what came in that was removed in this restored reach. And this is how it turned out. These are the results of the first 3 years of our study. In the first year, we looked at the pre-restoration condition, and that's represented by these blue bars here. And on this axis is the total removal expressed as a percent. So before the restoration, you can see for some of these things like phosphate, total phosphorus, ammonium, and total suspended solids, there was a negative removal rate. And that just means that there was actually more of a greater load leaving the restored reach than came in. It was exporting these different materials and nutrients. After the restoration, things look really different. So the orange bars represent that condition. And you can see for phosphate and total phosphorus and ammonium, the removal rates are close to 50% and maybe 50% here, and much higher. Of course, previously they were negative. The nitrate showed an increase in removal, and so did total nitrogen and total suspended solids. Now, we tested the statistical significance of it. Like we had to figure, like, what are the chances that there's just some kind of random fluctuation in nutrient concentration that made this appear to be a change related to our restoration. So we used a test for that called randomized intervention analysis, where the intervention is the restoration. And these probability numbers indicate which ones would be considered statistically significant. And that's true for phosphate, total phosphorus, ammonium, and total nitrogen. It means that there's a very high probability that this change was due to the restoration. It's funny that the highest percent removal was for total suspended solids, but that was not statistically significant. I think that's because suspended solids are very episodic in how they move. So you can get one or two events that give you these sort of wild-looking points. And well, we have some more data, though, and I'm looking forward to seeing if it starts to solidify on something. So we also looked at the comparison of the two watersheds to see how the effect was at a larger scale. But what we found was, comparing the treatment and the control watersheds, there was no statistically significant change in the loads that could be attributed to the restoration. Now, it's possible that the effects were masked by the effects of beaver ponds that exist downstream of the restoration in this watershed. This beaver pond at the bottom actually went in 1990, and we already had 15 years of data on the flows coming out of this watershed. So we kept studying it, and after 5 years, we compared the before and after the beaver pond, and we found that the beaver pond was able to take up a lot of nutrients. And in the meantime, the beavers over the intervening years have built other beaver ponds up here. So that may have masked the effect of the restoration. So we saw some other effects that seemed to be related to the restoration. Dissolved oxygen in the water seemed to decline afterwards. Unfortunately, we didn't have any data beforehand, but I suspect this really is an effect of the restoration. The orange dots here show the dissolved oxygen concentration at the upstream end. We measured that with a sensor that we put in the water, and we had another one like it downstream. And so the downstream oxygen is represented by the blue dots. And in 2016, the first year after the restoration, we saw a lot of oxygen depletion and times of hypoxia, which would be stressful to stream organisms. And in 2017, we saw some of the same trend, but not as strong. But in 2018, a very wet year, we still saw some oxygen depletion going on. One year we investigated this in a little bit more detail with the help of an intern, and she mapped the oxygen distribution around the restored reach. And she found that it was really variable depending on where you go. In general, it decreased as you move away. Let me back up so you can see the key. So the dots that are blue or black or green are high oxygen, and these red or yellow ones are low oxygen. So you can see there's a strip of high oxygen there, right in between some low oxygen sites. And you can see that too. If you look at the distance from Muddy Creek Road, where the culvert is, and you look at the dissolved oxygen, you can see how it goes up and down as you go further along.
The places where the oxygen came up, they usually were the riffles. And that makes sense, because when you have the water being shallow and a lot of turbulence, you can reoxygenate the water, which is another good thing about those riffles. Another thing we noticed in the first year,
we started to get these strange growths on the bottom of the stream, things that look like mushrooms or jellyfish or something. And those turned out to be bacteria colonies. And they seem to be iron oxidizing bacteria. They make a rusty red color. Doesn't come out so much in this photograph. It looks more brown, but sometimes it's really quite a bright orange. And this kind of thing has been seen in other stream restorations.
You can see in this picture as well, these sort of brownish blobs where the iron oxidizing bacteria is spreading. There's a concern about these bacteria because they do remove oxygen from the stream. They take some oxygen from the water and they combine it with iron to make iron oxide. And they get energy from that process that they can use to grow, just like a plant gets energy from sunlight. But when they're doing that, they're taking up oxygen. And so that can lower the oxygen. But also, they make these iron coatings on things that get in the way of stream invertebrates and benthic algae. So they're not really great for the health of the stream. But we don't know if they're going to persist. It might be a short-term effect of the restoration. Before the restoration, here's the cross-section of the stream. It was deeply eroded. It's a little bit of a levee on the side. There were lots of trees growing on the banks. The stream was acting like a drainage ditch, essentially, pulling water away from the banks. And when we looked at the water tables using our transects of wells, we could see that the water table sloped towards the stream, indicating that the water is flowing into the stream. It's just like a drainage ditch, basically. Afterwards, of course, we raised the stream. We also raised the water table. So here's our gravel and our wood chips, and the water table's up here now. And then we started to see the groundwater table sloping the other way, especially in the summer. And that reflects the demand for water from the trees that are in the floodplain. But another thing that happened is the trees that have been growing on the banks are trees that are adapted to well-drained soil. And so when their roots got submerged, they died, basically. And one of those trees tried to get revenge on us by throwing itself on our downstream auto sampler, but fortunately my crew wasn't there at the time, so it was okay. So another thing about the way the groundwater flows is that there was an intention in the design to try to induce groundwater to flow down through the sand layer. And the way that works is this way. So there's a gravel layer here, which can allow water to flow rapidly, more quickly than it can flow through sand. And then at the, as you go down the stream, it was less deeply incised because there's a clay layer there, and the stream had eroded down to the clay layer, and the floodplain was closer to the clay layer as you went downstream. So after getting to the place where it's not so deeply incised, they sort of tapered off on their sand and wood chips, but they kept the gravel going. So the idea was that the gravel could tap water out from underneath the sand layer, and that would induce a flow of groundwater down into and through the sand. And the wood chips in the sand would provide organic matter for bacteria that can convert nitrate to nitrogen gas by the process of denitrification. And also, the wood chips would provide organic matter to support the entire microbial community. So that was the idea. We've been trying to determine if that's really going on. It's hard to measure, but I just wanted to let you know that it was part of the plan. And we think that it is working in some places. So we looked at how the chemistry of the groundwater changed to see if it related to what we were seeing in the surface water. And this is a quick summary of it. These things decreased in concentration in the groundwater: phosphate, ammonium, sulfate, and pH. These things increased organic carbon, we think from the wood chips especially, but also organic carbon released from the decomposing roots of trees that are dying near the banks. Iron increased, probably because of low oxygen, but oxygen increased, but it was still low. But the thing is, when we flooded the soil that had been well drained, that experienced lower oxygen conditions. And that iron may have been mobilized from that layer that the groundwater came up through. We didn't see any change in nitrate, though, in the groundwater. So in general, the direction of change of these different things in the groundwater is similar to what we saw in the surface water. But we can't be sure that it's, you know, what we saw in the surface water is just due to what's going on in the groundwater. So I'm going to switch gears and start talking about the city stream. Here's our stream, this part here. This is the watershed outlined in blue. And this is the Annapolis Harbor Center here and the town center. So we've got a little bit of the harbor center in our watershed for our stream. And you can see what the land use is like here. There's a lot of impervious surface. Over 60% of it is of the watershed has impervious surface, and the water can't go through it. Up here we have some storage buildings. There's some retention ponds there. Then the stream goes under the road, under Route 50, and then all of this is underground in pipes, collecting drainage from these parking lots through storm drains. And then coming under Weaver Road, the stream pops out into the daylight for a little while, and then it goes into this sort of tunnel these big pipes that parallel RPM Boulevard. And then it pops out at the upstream end of our restored reach. This one was restored by something called a step pool stormwater conveyance. It's basically just a series of step pools. It doesn't involve putting in fill to raise the stream. One thing that's really striking about an urban watershed compared to a watershed that doesn't have so much impervious surface is that the water flow out of the watershed with a lot of impervious surface, there's going to be a lot more water flowing, and it flows in a very flashy way, really fast pulses. So this shows the stage, in other words, the depth of the stream at the Harbor Center. We were calling it RSC when I made this slide. I forgot about that. But you can see all these peaks, very sharp peaks, at the Harbor Center compared to Muddy Creek. These peaks are broader, and there's not so many of them. Look at this event here. Created a really big peak at the Harbor Center and just a tiny blip here. So it's, when you think about it, it's not surprising. When it rains on our parking lots, we want that rain to get off the parking lot as fast as it comes down. And so once it gets in the stream, it's really moving. And it makes it hard, actually, to measure things going on there. it's hard to measure the flow at different flow rates because it changes so rapidly. You go out there and you're trying to measure a high flow, and in 5 minutes it's down to nothing. Or, you know, if you're sampling, of course we have an automated sampler, but even the automated sampler could miss something because some of these events that, you know, for 10 minutes or so you have high turbidity and then it's gone. Anyway, so that's the environment you're working in, and it's very hard for these structures to slow down that water very much. And again, like I said before, it's not just the rate of flow, but how much is flowing, because when you have a lot of trees there, they're taking two-thirds of the water that fell on the watershed and sending it back up into the air. You don't have that in this highly paved environment. So here's an as-built diagram for that step pool stormwater conveyance. And you can see it's a series of pools, six in a row here. And this is where the flow comes in. There's a little stormwater retention pond here that has a drain here. There's sewage pipes here too. That's something common in the urban environment. Sewage pipes are usually buried along stream channels because that's the way the water flows. But that means that if there are any leaks in the sewage pipe, and there often are because at the joints and so on, then some sewage can get into the stream water. We didn't see anything that indicated that was happening at our site though. So we, of course, we put automated samplers at either end. That's what we do. this is what the upstream end looks like. This is the beginning of our stream. These pipes are big enough you can walk through them. There's our automated sampler, upstream end. And then you have these series of rock weirs, but really hefty ones. The first bunch of rock weirs they put in started to get washed out in the storm, so they had to beef them up a bit. Here's our downstream sampler. You can see the series of pools there. So the thing that we saw, the biggest change that we saw flowing through that restored reach was in nitrate concentration. So this is a plot of nitrate plus nitrite. Nitrite is a very small component, so I often just refer to it as nitrate. But this shows the concentration plotted against time. And the inlet part, the upstream end, is represented by the blue dots. And these red triangles represent the concentration at the downstream end. And you can see the concentration at the downstream end is usually a lot lower than at the upstream end. Something else we noticed, the concentration is pretty low everywhere. At CERC, we measure the nitrate concentration in rain, as well as ammonium and other substances we measure in rain routinely. So we know what the rain looks like, and nitrate concentrations in the rain tend to run up to maybe 1.3 milligrams nitrogen per liter at the most. The average is somewhere around 0.3 milligrams per liter. Minimum nitrate in rain, somewhere around 0.1 milligrams per liter. And look at how many of our downstream end points were below the minimum we see in rain. Altogether, we calculated that 70% of the nitrate plus nitrate was removed in transit along that restored reach. But there wasn't a whole lot there to begin with. So other nutrient forms and suspended solids were not noticeably removed. That includes ammonium, organic nitrogen, total nitrogen, and the total nitrogen consists of about 12% of it is nitrate. So even though nitrate's being removed, we didn't see that effect on the total nitrogen, probably because the total nitrogen is so much higher than nitrate, and there's a lot of variability in the total nitrogen. So it's hard to measure that uptake of the nitrate in the total. Phosphate and total phosphorus and total suspended solids, none of them showed significant uptake going through the stream. So we're also studying other parts of the Church Creek watershed. Yeah, it's an exciting watershed.
Yay, Church Creek watershed.
Yeah. So, this is our little SPSC. That's the one that I was just talking about. But since then, we started measuring loans right here at just site number 3, 4, and 5. And you can see these little hash marks here represent more step pools that were put in at the same time. So it's not just this little bit here, but we've got step pools running all the way to Route 2. And then there's a place here where county monitoring is going on, and another place where there's monitoring going on. And then this place is the end of this branch. And this one is in a very different branch with a lot of woods in it, less impervious surface. So we're in the process of comparing what's going on in those different places, and we want to relate that to the management practices that are going on in the different watersheds. Because once we add these other monitoring sites together, we can define all of these different watersheds outlined in those different patterns. And we can contrast what's coming out of them based on the land uses and management practices, stormwater management in particular. I wanted to highlight what was going on at the downstream end of that one, this one here, Site 4, which is getting all of the flow from all this developed land and going through these step pools and encountering these step pools here, the backup from those step pools. Because we saw some really interesting things going on there. With nitrate, we saw a really strong dip in the nitrate during the summer, really low concentrations. And we saw that at other sites too, but especially at Site 4. And at that same site, we saw ammonium doing the same thing, getting really low during the summer. But also, we saw that organic nitrogen tends to peak during the summer, especially the early summer. So it's possible that some of the nitrate and ammonium are actually being taken up and converted to organic nitrogen. Microorganisms can do that, algae, bacteria. They can assimilate nitrate and ammonium and make organic forms. And some of that organic nitrogen may be continuing on down the stream. But I was looking at the data just today really carefully, because there's some outliers up here, really high organic nitrogen values, and there's some even out against the plot, because it would stretch out the plot too much. But those were happening in the spring and early summer. And one thing we've learned from studying the rainfall at CERC, and you probably know from looking at your cars or decks in the spring, is that there's a lot of pollen in the spring and the summer that comes down from the sky in the rain or not in the rain. And that can land on the surfaces in the urban landscape or come down in the rain. And that may be part of the reason we're seeing this peak in organic nitrogen coming through the system at that time of the year. So anyway, where does the nitrate go in this watershed? We're not sure. It could be converted to nitrogen gas by denitrification, which would result in the production of N2 gas, which is the most abundant gas in our atmosphere. It's very inert. It's a great way to get nitrogen out of the system. It could be converted to organic nitrogen and held in the stream, or converted to organic nitrogen and carried downstream. So I wanted to compare what we see coming out of our watersheds to some other watersheds that I've studied over the years with all my colleagues here at CERC. This is a summary of some work looking at watersheds with different percentages of cropland. So percentage of cropland is plotted here. And the nitrate concentration in the stream draining the watershed is plotted here. And you can see, of course, as the percent cropland goes up, the nitrate concentration goes up. That's not surprising. What was really interesting to us is how different it was depending on what physiographic province you're in. The Piedmont lowlands, for example, that have calcareous substrate, those release maybe like 5 times as much nitrogen per acre of cropland than coastal plain farms do. And we looked to see if it was because of the farmers putting more manure or fertilizer on their fields. And that did not account for it. So there's a lot of difference in the leakiness of watersheds depending on geological features. So I wanted to plot, you know, what's going on with these urban watersheds that we've been looking at in the Harbor Center on this graph, and they would be down here somewhere because the nutrient concentrations were really quite low. And also to bring home that point, this is a comparison of the two different restored streams, looking at the concentrations of different things at the inlet and the outlet. So the blue bars are for the inlet and the orange for the outlet. I just labeled these, but that's the way, you know, that's the way the symbols work all the way across. So here's nitrate. These are all to scale. These are different forms of nitrogen. You can see that the nitrate coming in into Muddy Creek is higher than going out, and same with the Harbor Center. At Muddy Creek, we couldn't find a statistically significant pattern in the nitrate, but we're analyzing it statistically differently. We're looking at the before and after there at Muddy Creek, but we were not able to get before data at the Harbor Center. So we're just looking at upstream versus downstream, the mass balance. But the nitrate picture is pretty similar at the two places, but not so for ammonium. You can see Muddy Creek has a lot higher ammonium concentrations coming in, and it drops the ammonium a lot down. The Harbor Center has low ammonium coming in and going out. Total nitrogen, Muddy Creek has way more coming in into the inlet, and it brings it down quite a bit. The Harbor Center, it's low going in and low going out. You know, I was looking at this today and just thinking about, this reminds me of the situation with the beaver ponds at the downstream end of the Muddy Creek restoration. We saw some removal, you know, down to a certain point, but after that, it was really hard to get it down any further. And it almost seems like the Harbor Center is already like as low as you can go, pretty much. But this is just like, these are just impressions and speculation at this point. So here's what's going on with phosphorus and suspended solids. Similar story. A lot more phosphate coming into Muddy Creek than coming into the Harbor Center. And Muddy Creek takes a lot out in its restored reach. The Harbor Center is just low going in, low going out. Total phosphorus, same thing. Total suspended solids, pretty much the same story there. So comparing the city stream and the country stream, the urban step pool stormwater conveyance retained about 70% of the nitrate input. The SPSC effects are really uncertain without the pre-restoration data, because maybe before restoration it was exporting nitrate and it stopped doing that. So it's hard to say, but we at least can say what the mass balance is telling us. Low concentrations in the summer suggest biological uptake in the streams because it's warmer in the summer and biological activity is faster then. Nitrate concentrations in the urban streams were low compared to rainfall and agricultural watersheds. The country stream, Muddy Creek, RSC, removed high percentages of phosphate, total phosphorus, ammonium, total nitrogen, and total suspended solids. But the changes in the removal rates of total nitrogen and total suspended solids after restoration were not statistically significant, at least for the 2 years we analyzed. We have some more data to analyze now. I just haven't gotten around to that yet. So I have some parting thoughts. Before restoring streams to remove nutrients, maybe one should measure the nutrient concentrations to see if there's a lot there that need to be removed. They don't do that. When you write a proposal to get money to do a stream restoration, you use an assumed concentration. This is what they tell you to do. Use an assumed concentration for urban runoff, which is sort of average concentration, which is higher than what we're seeing at Harbor Center. Also, consider ways to reduce the source. Suppose you're seeing really super high concentrations, and it might mean that there's a leaky sewer pipe. Well, maybe you should fix the sewer pipe. So runoff from impervious surfaces is very destructive to stream ecosystems. There's no way around that. I mean, this, it's unbelievable when you get in those systems and you see the way the water just rips the place up. You can go in there and engineer the heck out of it and build all kinds of weirs and retaining walls and dams and stuff, and you can stabilize the stream so it won't erode or change very much. But the water is still going to rip through there pretty fast. And it's hard to take any nutrients out of the water when it's flying by that fast. And it's hard for organisms to live in that kind of environment. De-icing salts and other substances pollute urban runoff and should be managed. We're really paying a lot of attention to nutrients because of Chesapeake Bay. But these other things are serious pollutants. De-icing salts are bad for stream organisms, and there's heavy metals and certain toxins, petroleum byproducts that they get in, you know, from runoff from parking lots. And I wasn't measuring that because that wasn't what I was studying. So I need to thank a lot of people because a lot of people worked on this project. My co-investigator, Cindy Gilmore, postdocs, Will Brogan and Josh Thompson, my technicians, Carrie Pelt, has especially been involved over the years, and so many other technicians. Some of them, the reason there's such a long list is some of them were part-time or short-term technicians, and Carrie had to train all these folks when they came in to work. And then there was a whole bunch of interns that came and did a lot of interesting studies, usually proving me wrong about things. And then citizen scientist volunteers really doing a great job. There's no way we could get all this work done without them. And also our partners with the what used to be called the South River Federation, now the Arundel Rivers Federation. Sarah Giordano, she's here in the audience, Jesse Eilu, Wayne Martin, Dan Muller, and Kate Fritz used to be with the organization. They were instrumental in getting the first grants. And also, we'd like to thank all these organizations for support. We pieced together these studies, the funding for these studies from a lot of different sources. And thank you for listening.
Tom, thank you so much. And we're going to get some lights. And there we go. So I'm actually going to give this.
Plunge into the darkness here. There
you go. Okay. Gotta love technology. Why don't you take the mic and you got a question?
So we actually, usually we can't get the mic to everyone in time, so I'm going to ask Tom to repeat the question after.
That's a great idea. That's a more better idea.
Yes, Sarah.
Hey.
I know some surprises in this.
No, thank you for all this. Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about the complications of the various inputs at such an urban site like Harbor Center? Because I know that had confounding factors and variables.
The complications of the input?
Right.
You have to give me a little bit more.
Well, we had an upstream.
Tom, use the microphone so we can hear what the questions are.
So I was just asking about if Tom could elaborate on the complications of some of the inputs at such an urban site, because there's an upstream and a downstream station, but we had so many extra.
Okay, that's a very good question. She's asking about the complication of the inputs, meaning the stream network. A stream network is really complicated, very branchy. And so the reason we studied that tiny little snippet of stream there at the headwaters to see what was going on with the step pool conveyance is that if we studied a longer stream, there'd be a major tributary coming into it somewhere. And so it's really hard to sort all of that stuff out. But so what we did is we did some short-term studies or spot sampling campaigns where Sarah rounded up a bunch of volunteers to go out into the stream network
and sample all around different places. And we did find some hotspots of nitrate concentration. But I don't know how much nitrate they were actually contributing, because we don't yet know the area of draining to each of those places, but we're working on that. Is that what you want me to talk about?
Yeah, and just, yeah. You know.
It makes it hard to understand what's going on out there.
Right, yeah. It complicates the results.
It is. It's hard to work in that environment with the flashy flow and everything. And that's the complicated network. That's in the back.
I have a quick question. Have you looked at suburban streams and done a similar study? Because suburban streams have a high level of lawns that have fertilizer going in, and I would imagine that it would fall someplace between farmland and impervious covered, you know, I'm not sure what the inputs in terms of nitrogen and things like that would be. And that, from a management perspective, lawns have been found to be a big source, particularly like in urban areas. And that sometimes gets downplayed because of the large amount of agriculture in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think you probably could hear what she said because she had the microphone. I haven't studied a suburban watershed, but I agree, there's a lot more sources there. You mentioned the lawn fertilizer. I just read a paper recently that said pet waste is a big thing. And you know, I'm sure that the people are not walking their dogs in the parking lots of these shopping centers and car dealerships. So we don't have that problem where I study. And although there's some apartments off to the side of it. And then, as you mentioned, the lawns. There's been some studies of lawns that show them to be very retentive of nitrogen, but I'm sure there's a limit to how much they can retain. But you're right, there's some other. And another thing about suburban watersheds, sometimes they're not on sewers, so they have septic tanks. And there have been a lot of studies of watersheds with a lot of septic tanks that have found lots of nitrate coming out. Lots of hands up here.
He's got the microphone here. I've been trying to get the microphone to everyone, but I might miss some people, so please keep raising your hands.
Okay.
I hope I'm wrong in my interpretation of what you're saying, but it sounds to me like you're saying that all these restoration projects, particularly in the urban areas, are not that effective at removing nitrates and phosphorus from the water stream. Is that correct, or did I get that wrong?
That's not right, because I've only studied one of them. So I can't go from one watershed and say all of them, or many of them, are not doing much, you know? But what it does tell me is that some of them might not be doing much. And we should be on the lookout for that. That's why I suggested it might be good to require that people measure some nutrients in their watershed first to show that there's something to take up. How about your quote?
Referring to the RSC at Muddy Creek, when you put it in, I noticed it was above the beaver ponds, and you chose it at a culvert exit.
Yes.
How important, I also noticed that a lot of the meander was preserved. Was that taken into account? And what, other than the fact that the erosion was terrible at that culvert, what other factors did you have to take into account that would not destroy the downstream portion?
I don't remember actually being worried that the stream restoration would destroy the downstream portion, because there's all those beaver dams down there, and the restoration should, if anything, slow the water down by reconnecting the stream to its floodplain. So our expectation is that it would be good for what was downstream. We have lots of reasons to do the restoration besides trying to take up nutrients. We're a research place, so this was an opportunity to do a field experiment right there on the site and study the heck out of it. And so that was a big factor. But also, it wasn't a good stream habitat in many ways. And so, you know, there's something to be gained from restoring the habitat. Now, I didn't talk about how much the habitat was restored. There's some folks with the Department of Natural Resources that are looking at the stream and bird rights, and so far they're not seeing much response to the stream and macro invertebrates. But we have seen a lot of amphibians coming in, and so I'm pretty sure that there's been a positive response.
Could you talk about the specific effects that you might expect to see from pesticides and herbicides in the nitrogen content or the oxygen content?
The short answer is probably no, because I've studied pesticides or herbicides. Well, I can imagine that it could have an effect. Certainly, if you have a lot of toxic stuff in the stream, even if you made a nice habitat for the stream invertebrates, they might be poisoned. And in fact, that might be some of what's going on in the urban environment, where even the salts are toxic to those organisms. That's as much as I can do for you on that one. Yes.
In the RSC, what do you think would be the lifetime of the wood chips, and then what happens when they decay?
Yeah, I wouldn't think that the wood chips would last very long. I thought they'd go away in like a year or two, like wood chips in my yard go away. But we're still seeing some depletion of oxygen there. Now, one thing about the wood chips I've learned from the practitioners, the people that build these restorations, is that they use a certain mixture of what they call green wood chips and wood chips that have been mulched for a while. And it's possible that those green wood chips decompose very rapidly. We had an intern work on the project measuring the availability of the organic carbon released by wood chips that were kept in water in the lab. And it was extremely what we call labile, available to the microorganisms. He did comparisons between glucose and wood chip organic matter, and they were eating them at equal rates. So it was extremely available stuff. And you think that wouldn't last very long.
Tom? Here I am, Betsy.
Yeah.
Could you speak a bit to the difference in the two methodologies that were used in the study, RSC versus the step pool stormwater conveyances?
Yeah.
I see them as somewhat very different because of the introduction of groundwater and carbon. The importance of the wood chips and the carbon in the RSC. And one other thing I wanted, just two questions, about the iron flock. Do you know of any studies that are being done on the positive effects of iron flock presence in the water? Because I'm just saying that because as a child, I played in a stream where there was iron flock, and I caught crayfish and salamanders in there, so I don't know whether it was a matter of a long time that it was there or what, but it was a gold mine stream once upon a time, so that might be the iron flock in that stream that I grew up in. But if you know of any studies, do you know of any studies about the long-term effects of iron flock?
No, I don't know of any studies about any potential benefits of iron flock, except for the iron oxidizing bacteria. But I have noticed that the amphibians in our stream, they'll swim around in those pools that look like tomato soup or something. They're okay there. I think it's a rough place for the inverts to live. As far as how the RSC differs from the SPSC, the RSC, there's a lot of attention to try to make it regenerative in the sense that using the living organisms that you can support by your
restoration of the stream, especially the plants, you know, encourage submerged vegetation, stream bank vegetation, floodplain vegetation. All of that will, you know, help with the restoration naturally. That's why the name has regeneration in it. Whereas the step pool conveyances are more like a sort of engineering thing where you put down a row of rocks and then you put down another row of rocks. And and yet those doing that also could have benefits to the stream. And in an urban environment, you know, it might be the best you can do.
But both have the sand and mulch. It's just a matter of whether you fill in the stream.
Yeah, the one that I studied, they didn't really, I don't think they put much in for anything. Well, they put some root rods in.
But through, they put in sand and mulch as well.
They did?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know
that. I was there, I saw.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
We have time for one more question. Mm-hmm. I'm in favor of this side of the room, somebody over to this side. Actually, would you mind passing the microphone down to this gentleman in the navy jacket? Thanks.
Okay, I'm wondering about the role of vegetation, both along the stream and the submerged and marsh vegetation downstream, in absorbing nitrogen.
Vegetation can be very important. We now in Muddy Creek has a lot of submerged vegetation growing in it, but after the floodplain got flooded, we saw a lot of things die in the floodplain. I mentioned the trees, but also we saw spice bush areas get killed off too. But now, you know, other things are coming in. So I would think that, you know, vegetation would be very important for the nutrient uptake and also for shading the stream. We lost some of that shading when the stream bank trees died. But, I don't know if that covers what you're.
And also, what's the role of denitrification?
Denitrification? Well, I think denitrification potentially is very important because it really gets rid of the nitrogen rather than trying to store it where it might later on be released. But it's very hard to measure it in the field. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do that, and it's mixed success. Yeah, I'd love to know more about
that. I think you mentioned it as one of the positive roles of riparian buffers.
Yeah, so for sure, yeah. We've seen evidence of that with the decline of the nitrate. And the riparian buffers we studied back in the 80s, we didn't see enough growth of vegetation to account for the nitrate declines we were seeing in the groundwater.
All right. Well, thank you all very, very much.